authorities accused Russia of directing hacks into the U.S. election system.
We have learned that the FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails may have been influenced by a document that turned out to be a fake, possibly from the Russians.
Russian military intelligence tried to cyber attack an American voting software supplier in the days leading up to last presidential election.
With midterm elections upon us, intelligence officials warn of widespread Russian efforts to disrupt the upcoming cycle. And more attention is being pointed at the security of the voting machines we use every election day, a vehicle for democracy that could also be used to undermine it.
The main thing that's a huge concern here, I think, is if you look at things like swing states. One state can cause an election process or an election cycle to be thrown one way or the other.
Many states still have old electronic voting machines, meaning it's theoretically possible some could be hacked and the votes manipulated.
So I think if we go and we look at the voting systems, we say if people don't trust the voting systems, if they don't trust the information that they're getting, if they don't trust that the system's actually going to work, what are they going to do? They're just not going to interact with it, right? They're just going to stay home.
Though, what if we could vote from home on a smartphone?
So it seemed to me that if there was one mechanism where we could both materially make our election safer and really drive participation and turnout, we should do that.
But mobile voting could bring a whole new set of problems.
Oh my God, I'm just thinking about like all the stories I've written over the years about security flaws in internet-connected devices. Adding voting to that is a daunting proposition.
This episode, we visit one of the world's largest hacker conventions where voting machines are put to the test, and we ask, what will it take to secure them and our whole electoral process?
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
Hotel ballrooms host all kinds of conferences for all kinds of industries, from insurance to healthcare. This one at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, it's called DEF CON, and it's the place hackers come to show their skills.
We're holding a special election for president on the AccuVote TSX voting machine.
Alex Halderman directs the Center for Computer Security and Society at the University of Michigan. He's demonstrating how this voting machine could be remotely hacked to a group of journalists, elections officials, and other folks. It's made by a company called Diebold, and in 2006, it was the most used voting machine in the country. It's still used by 18 states.
So our choices are George Washington or Benedict Arnold, the traitor of the revolution. And I, for one, am a patriot. I'm going to vote for George Washington. Who else wants to vote? Any other patriots here? You want to cast a vote?
One person volunteers.
So these cards are used in the real machines. They're used to authenticate the voter. You sign in at the polling place, sign your name or show your ID, depending on the state, and the election officials will activate one of these cards for you. That entitles you to one vote.
Another person steps up to vote, and here's when Halderman lets us in on the secret.
I didn't have to reactivate this card between voters. That's because this is a look-alike memory card. Our look-alike card lets you cast as many votes as you want. So a voter could keep putting in the card, casting more votes, until somebody noticed that they were taking a really long time at the machine.
Everyone uses the same card without a problem. Then he tallies the votes.
Okay, we've had three votes, and we know, because this isn't a secret ballot, that the real total is two votes for George Washington, one vote for Benedict Arnold.
He does what an official would do at the end of election day and punches in a PIN number. A receipt prints out the vote totals.
All right, and the winner of our election, Benedict Arnold, two votes to one. Benedict Arnold has won by a slight margin, and that's because the malicious code that I infected the machine with on that memory card stole the election. The malware I loaded on here ensures that candidate number two wins by a small margin if candidate two didn't win outright.
The folks I'm standing with lean in a little closer. Those who clearly haven't seen this demo before start to look a little anxious.
We know of dozens of different vulnerabilities in the software, many of which will let someone infect the machine with malicious code via the memory cards that program the ballots before the election. You can exploit any of those routes to get malicious code on and tamper with the votes. All of the electronic records of the votes are going to be manipulable by that software.
This is the second year DEF CON invited hackers to physically break into voting machines. The idea is to bring awareness to the state of voting security. Benjamin Dolan shows me around.
So the table we're currently at now is a table of all the goodies that go with each of the voting machines at the village. This is all stuff that the average DEF CON goer wouldn't have on hand.
They're uncovering hardware problems.
So what we have is we have a bunch of really old flash disks. Like, we have 128 megabyte flash disk. We have infrared readers and writers that are used with one specific type of voting machine that is unlocked using only a magnet and infrared light, which is pretty dangerous since anyone can obtain those two things.
And they're even finding ways to hack into machines by rummaging around the internet.
A lot of the passwords for these are published online and are something as simple as A, B, C, D, E. And when that's a password that is a set admin password that can't be changed and has been on Google since 2008, 2009, we should probably start changing some things.
This is just one of many worries security experts have with voting technology. Chris Weissopel is the co-founder of Veracode.
So for a long time, election security was focused on the voting machines. It was all about the voting machines. People would buy them on eBay, and they would show how they're insecure. You can pick the lock, and you can put a USB drive in there and reprogram it. And it's one of those things that's like, well, but that's not a scalable attack. But I think when you start to look at the entire sort of ecosystem of the whole voting process, you start to see that there's all these other pieces that are probably more attractive vectors to attackers.
Pieces beyond the machine itself. Pieces that involve our whole voting infrastructure.
Things like, you know, attacking the voter registration process, you know, to steal names, but it seems like it could be modified. The other problem that we saw happen was the election management system is where all the votes get tallied together. And, you know, that's multiple computers. You have to have some way of communicating to them. So you now you have a little bit more complex system that a lot of people have access to. And then you realize that someone's writing that software. And you start to worry about supply chain attacks. So if that has to be secure, then all the companies making the software that's going there has to be secure.
In March, Congress passed a spending bill allotting $380 million to shore up election cybersecurity. It's seen as the first step the government has taken on that front since the 2016 campaign. Robert McMillan writes about computer security, hackers, and privacy for the Wall Street Journal.
There needs to be kind of like a steady stream of funding for these systems to keep them up to date, to keep them secure. Hacking doesn't stand still. So there's always going to be a new kind of threat. There's always going to be room for improvement.
In August, Senate Democrats proposed an amendment that would have added $250 million to the bill. But Republicans blocked it, saying they'd like to see what can be done with the initial budget first.
Well, you know, one thing that surprised me as I've looked into this is the extent to which it is a partisan issue. Whether the machines are secure or not is a technical issue, and that's sort of outside of politics, right? Like, you can make a logical argument about whether a machine is connected to the internet or not, whether it has flaws in it or not, whether the votes on it could be tampered or not. It's just a strict up engineering problem that we either want to solve or we don't, and I don't see why you wouldn't want to solve it.
Georgia considered getting rid of voting machines altogether. They're one of the states that uses the AccuVote TSX we heard getting hacked into earlier. Locals petitioned to go back to a paper ballot system, but the petition was denied, both by the state board and a U.S. district judge. Maybe reverting back to a complete paper ballot isn't reasonable in the 21st century, but a paper trail is important for auditing votes.
I think most people who study election security agree that you need a backup. You need a paper trail just to double check things. And the fact that we don't have that everywhere in the United States is a problem. It really is.
Some are betting on the paper trail's digital equal, blockchain, to securely store votes. One of those people is venture capitalist Bradley Tusk, a former campaign manager for Michael Bloomberg and an early investor in Uber.
So blockchain, at least right now, is a totally unhackable system where because any record is distributed among so many different computers and anytime it's altered, everybody sees it instantaneously. I'm sure one day people will figure out how to hack blockchain, but right now there's no way to do it at all.
Several startups are looking to pair blockchain technology with mobile voting. One of them is called Votes. It works like this. Users download an app. It requires a process that's kind of like the two-step verification you might have on your email account. It scans your fingerprint for use every time you open the app. Then you take pictures of your ID. Vote CEO Nimit Sawhney.
Then the next step is the phone will prompt you to take a live selfie of yourself. So you have to move your face up and down, left, right, blink your eyes. Essentially, it tries to make sure that you are not taking a picture of a picture or a picture of another video.
It uses facial recognition technology, like Apple's Face ID, to collect, match, and verify your identity. Then you sign in on your phone and cast your vote.
We can keep saying that because the internet is not safe, we should never do anything on the internet. I mean, then why do we do banking? Why do we do other transactions there? And so why can't the same principle apply to an election system? It comes from a good place, and we accept that security is paramount. But at the same time, if you don't try this, if you don't try to build a resilient system, then we will never have anything better.
Although, to be fair, banks plan for at least some fraud loss, and we're not okay with any amount of election fraud. Still, Votes was tested during May's primaries in West Virginia by military troops voting via absentee ballots, and West Virginia officials say the pilot was a success. The state will continue using it in some counties for midterms. Bradley Tusk funded West Virginia's pilot and is offering to do the same for any other states that want to test a blockchain platform.
The scope is small, but I think because of that, I feel like I'm in a position to probably finance a dozen states, 15 states, 20 states in different pilots and trying different ideas. And if after the conclusion of all of that, it hasn't caught on, then we failed. And if it has, then ultimately the responsibility of funding elections is the government's and not an individual's, and they'll pay for it.
But Tusk thinks this is just the beginning. He hopes to focus on new demographics for mobile voting in the future, such as people with disabilities or those living in rural areas who can't easily make it to the polls.
Once the genie comes out of the bottle, you can never put it back in. And thanks to West Virginia, the genie started coming out of the bottle. And luckily, as long as there are enough brave election officials around the country who are willing to give it a try, who see how broken our current system is and want to make things better, the genie's going to keep slipping out of the bottle more and more and more.
A lot of security researchers are very skeptical of this and say this is insecure. Mobile voting in general is insecure. There are so many reasons not to do it. And just because this one is using blockchain doesn't mean that it's solving any of the security problems that come with mobile voting.
Cybersecurity reporter Catherine Stupp with WSJ Pro.
As cryptography develops, eventually, years from now, encryption that is protecting these votes could be cracked and your votes could be exposed and therefore no longer be secret.
In other words, new tech eventually succumbs to time and turns into outdated tech. Security flaws become more and more visible. The same goes for encryption. But she says that's not stopping other states interested in blockchain voting.
There are two cities in Colorado that are looking into blockchain-based voting, and I discovered that in my reporting through talking to the National Cybersecurity Center, which is based in Colorado. It's a nonprofit organization, and they are working with the cities of Denver and Colorado Springs to develop these apps. So far, the cities and their elections officials want to kind of keep this a bit under wraps, and they're going to announce more details about it in October.
And while voting online is buzzworthy in the U.S., the tech-forward country Estonia in Northern Europe has successfully held internet-based elections since 2005. Citizens have government-issued ID cards with scannable chips. They insert the cards into their computer to download the voting portal.
They said, this works perfectly fine with our digital government IDs, which all citizens here have. They don't use smartphones, and they don't use browsers. So voters use their digital government ID to log in, verify their identity, and then they vote through a secure portal that is not connected to a browser.
Estonia's election task force monitors the online system around the clock leading up to elections. It looks for disruptions in software and hardware, as well as access to critical data or unauthorized changes. It also watches for votes that can't be cast due to error. Estonia does all this because of a history of electronic attacks by Russia, and election security here in the U.S. is getting a lot more attention now for similar reasons. Back in July, federal investigators accused Russian officials of attempting to hack into state election agencies, as well as voting software companies.
The indictment charges 13 Russian nationals and 3 Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system, including the 2016 presidential election.
Intelligence officials warn that Moscow is likely to try again this year, potentially casting doubt on the legitimacy of the midterm election results.
The main thing that's a huge concern here, I think, is if you look at things like swing states, where one state can cause an election process or an election cycle to be thrown one way or the other.
David Kennedy is the former chief security officer of Diebold, the maker of those outdated voting machines. He's also a former NSA hacker and the founder of several cybersecurity companies.
So as an adversary, can we conduct an offensive against a swing state that could cause an election to go one way or the other? And I think that is much easier than saying, hey, we can hack the entire election process and change the vote from one person to a different person.
I asked him, if someone does hack our voting systems, are we sure we'll even know?
And the answer to that is most probably not. And that's a big deal. If we can't detect the intrusions, we can't detect manipulations in the voting environments, that is probably the worst out of all of it.
Kennedy says we have to start thinking about this not just in terms of our elections, but in terms of national security.
I mean, and military is still important, but it's no longer who has the bigger bombs or the best jets or anything else. It really has to do with who has the best hackers.
But the biggest possible disruption to our elections might have nothing to do with voting machines at all. Again, The Wall Street Journal's Robert McMillan.
Most of the problems that were uncovered at DEF CON this year involved getting your hands on a machine or sneaking into a polling booth. And that's something that the Russians are unlikely to do because they've already shown they can wreak a lot of havoc from foreign shores. They don't need to come here to mess around with our election. The real fear that a lot of people have is that the Russians will not change the vote, but undermine the integrity of the vote.
As we've already seen, election security goes way beyond voting. Russia hacked the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign and flooded Facebook with propaganda. And McMillan says these are the ways voting can really be changed in our upcoming election.
You can do that by having the registration databases all wiped out. So when people show up at the polls, it's not clear who's registered to vote and who's not. You could do that by hacking a website like the Wall Street Journal and having us publish false vote results. Or you could go after the websites run by the different counties that announce the voting results and mess around with those. So there could be a sense of, well, it looks like this person won, and then you have to call that back because it was a web hack. And a lot of people feel that that kind of confuse and undermine the integrity of the election is what's most likely to happen. So the fact that there are all these security problems in the machines that we actually vote on is a big deal, I think, but it's not the most likely attack vector this election.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Garrett Crow and Kristen Schwab, with help from Stephen Rosenbusch, Robert McMillan, and Catherine Stupp. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in the newsroom in New York.